We continue our discussion of the servant theme. We were in chapter 50 at the close of the last hour. We didn't quite finish that. That's the third major passage. Let me put this up as we start, just for review. We're down here to 54 to 11. Remember, in this passage, the stress is on the humiliation of the servant. And you read in 6, I gave my back to the smiters, my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. Verse 5, I think very important because it speaks of the character of the servant. I was not rebellious, neither turned backward. So it seems clear from this passage, with the voluntary suffering and character of the servant, that it must be an individual and one distinguished from Israel as the nation. I think we had discussed down through verse 7. 7 says, for the Lord God will help me, therefore shall I not be confounded, therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed. I mentioned that Luke 9:53 says that Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. So let's pick up from that point and look at 8 through 11. 8 and 9 read, he is near who justifieth me. Who will contend with me? Let us stand together. Who is mine adversary? Let him come near to me. Behold, the Lord God will help me. Who is he that shall condemn me? Lo, they shall all grow old like a garment. The moth shall eat them up. You come to 8 and 9, I think there's a question whether it is the servant who continues to speak. The servant has been speaking. You see in verse 6, I gave my back to the smiters. 7, the Lord will help me. Question is the servant continuing to speak and declaring his certainty that God will enable him to finish the work he has been called to do? Or is it one of those speaking who believes in the finished work of the servant, the finished work of Christ? And one then who proclaims that the one who has justified me is near. I'm inclined to think the latter. He is near who justifieth me. In other words, the one speaking here is not the servant, but one who trusts in the work of the servant. And because the one who has justified him is near, then he is ready to face any adversary in the knowledge that he is safe, because God has procured his justification and God is ready to protect him. And then all who oppose the work of God will grow old like a garment, the last phrase of 9. Moths shall eat them up. Only those who are true to the Lord remain safe forever. Now, whether that transition, you see, is in 8 and 9, you can perhaps debate that. I think you're clearly into a transition in verses 10 and 11. See, 10 and 11 begin, who is among you that feareth the Lord? Servant is no longer speaking there. This is addressed to other people. I think in 10 and 11, you have a statement addressed to two classes of people. One class in 10, another class in 11. First, it's those who fear the Lord. Who is among you that feareth the Lord? And second, in verse 11, it's addressed to another group, those who kindle opposition to the Lord, or instigate opposition to the Lord. See, 10 says, who is among you that feareth the Lord, that obeyeth the voice of his servant, follows the servant, that walketh in darkness and hath no light, let him trust in the name of the Lord and stay upon his God. 11 says, behold, all ye that kindle a fire, that compass yourselves about with sparks, walk in the light of your fire and in the sparks that ye have kindled. This shall ye have of mine hand, ye shall lie down in sorrow. So, statements addressed to two classes of people. The first class, those that trust the Lord. Who is among you that feareth the Lord, that obeyeth the voice of the servant? But then a rather surprising statement, that walketh in darkness and hath no light. Let him trust in the name of the Lord and stay upon his God. I think the point there is, those that trust the Lord should do so even though they cannot see the way ahead. They don't know what the future holds. But they can safely trust in God and know that God will be with them and bring them through. So, even the believers, in a sense, walk in darkness, because none of us know what is before us. Yet, in light of that, we are to trust the Lord and be confident and assured that He will be with us. The contrast to that's in verse 11. 11 tells the fate of those that try to walk in the light of their own devices. Behold, all you that kindle a fire and compass yourself about with sparks. Walk in the light of your fire. People that try to walk in the light of their own devices. And really what 11 says, that by their own fires they're going to perish. They will lie down in everlasting sorrow and torment. So these two verses point up two possibilities. You may accept the finished work of the servant and trust in the servant and enjoy the peace that comes from that in knowing that God is with you. Or you can resist the Lord, try to walk in the light of your own devices, oppose the work of the servant, and ye shall lie down in sorrow. So that's the end of this next to the last servant passage. That's number 9, Isaiah 54 to 11. Notice I've underlined the major passages. That's the third major passage. And that brings us to the final passage, which is the fourth major one, Isaiah 52:13 through 53:12. Yes.
On your sheet up there, you have Isaiah 48.
Yeah. The L. I don't know what the L there is. 48:16. That's just a typo. 48:16 is that verse with the problem of interpretation in it we looked at last hour. Servant isn't mentioned in 16, but it's clear, I think, because of the particulars that the servant is speaking. Just ignore that L. Okay? All right, 52:13. Here we come to the climactic passage about the redemptive work of the servant. The interesting thing is, it's the last time that the word servant is mentioned in the book of Isaiah. You read that in verse 13, behold my servant shall deal prudently. It's the last reference, explicit reference to the servant. Subsequent to this climactic passage, you do have the plural use of the term. After this, you read about the servants, plural of God, but never the servant. In other words, what follows focuses on those who follow the servant and those who then are the servants of the Lord. But this is the climax of the work of the servant himself. And the interesting thing, too, I might just mention, it's unfortunate that the chapter division is between 52:15 and 53:1. Been far better to put the chapter division after 52:12, because 13 through 15 of 52 flows right on into chapter 53, and it's certainly a unit question.
So after 53, you see a chronological distinction between the coming of Christ and those who serve the Lord after, but before 53, you don't see chronology? That hasn't been mentioned.
No, I wouldn't say you don't see chronology. I think the point is that after 53, you see the results of the work of the servant. And that...
Even the 53 seem, you know, just enumerate different facts.
Yeah. I think you're right, from 41 to 53. I think there's progression, but I wouldn't call it a chronology. I'd say it's progression in development of the idea of the servant. You know, at first it's not too clear, and there are a lot of questions you can ask, and it gradually takes on more shape and more form as it fills out, as it develops. But after 53, then you move into not so much the work of the servant as the results of the work of the servant, what implications that has in outworking. All right, prior to 52:13 and following, we've had some hints that the servant is distinct from Israel. And that became particularly clear in 49, 5, and 6, where the servant is to bring Jacob again to him. And in verse 6, it is a light thing that thou shouldst be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the nations. In other words, in 49, 5, and 6, it's quite clear there's a distinction made between the servant and Israel. Servants of Israel, out of Israel, but is distinct from Israel. And then in 50 that we just looked at, when the servant says, I was not rebellious nor turned backward, certainly can't apply to Israel. So we've seen hints of that, and then it becomes clear in 49. He's Israel in a certain sense because he comes out of Israel and represents Israel, but he can be distinguished from the nation as a whole. And this servant then is called to perform a great work, to be a light to the Gentiles. Israel's fallen into sin. It's impossible for Israel to carry out the great task of bringing light to the nations. Israel's blind. How can she bring light? So the work is to be carried out by the one who represents Israel. Now look at your citations. Page 30. I've taken a couple paragraphs there from O.T. Alice's book, The Unity of Isaiah, which is quite a good little booklet. Notice what he says on this question of who is the servant. Is it Israel? Is it someone distinguished from Israel? Is it messianic? He says, this fact is illustrated by the following statement regarding Isaiah 53, which was made some years ago, but would apply equally well to the present situation. Quote, the majority of Christian scholars now hold the Jewish interpretation that though the picture is highly individualized, it still refers to the suffering nation. End of quote. Yeah. Majority of Christian scholars, that's speaking broadly. Yeah. He's quoting someone else there. But that, undoubtedly, if you look at the field of academic study of the Bible from Protestant and Catholic schools, that would be a true statement. You know, you could debate whether you want to call them Christian scholars, perhaps, but they would call themselves that. He says this statement is too sweeping, even if the word critical were substituted for Christian, as in all fairness should be done. For while, as we have seen, the, quote, suffering nation interpretation is widely held by critical scholars, there are other solutions which are or have been more or less popular. The reason for the quotation is that the writer did not hesitate to describe what he regarded as the most generally accepted critical interpretation as the Jewish interpretation. It is important to note, therefore, that there is good and reliable evidence to show that this was not the original Jewish interpretation. The Targum of Jonathan, recognized as official by the Babylonian Talmud, begins Isaiah 52:13 with the words, "Behold, my servant, the Messiah, shall prosper." Now, you know, Targums are Aramaic translations of the Hebrew, usually with some paraphrase. But the Targum of Jonathan identifies the servant as the Messiah. And there is other evidence that the Messianic interpretation was current among the Jews in early times, despite the fact that the description of the humiliation, death, and resurrection of the servant constituted a problem, which they were naturally quite unable to solve. It was apparently not until the Middle Ages that distinguished Jewish scholars such as Rashi, Ibn Ezra, the Kimchis, adopted the Israel interpretation, although that interpretation was known as early as the time of Origen. Insofar as they had the Christian interpretation of view, their object in adopting this rival interpretation was to destroy the connection between the Old Testament prophecy and what they believed to be the mistakenly alleged fulfillment of it, recorded in the New Testament, the death of Jesus of Nazareth. See, that is a powerful Christian argument for Jesus being the Messiah, that connection. A special reason for calling attention to this matter is that it raises the vitally important question, how can scholars who profess to be Christians accept an interpretation which is designed and intended to destroy the connection between the Old Testament, which they and the Jews accept, and the New Testament, which they accept and the Jews reject, and at the same time expect to maintain that connection between the two, which for centuries Christians, on the basis of the express claims of the New Testament, have regarded as perfectly obvious? How can they break down the bridge and maintain the connection intact? Or are they ready to confess that the Jews are right in maintaining that there is no such connection? Which must mean, of course, that the New Testament writers were, and here's an example of a scribal error. There's been a line left out. You might, after were, draw a line and insert this, because then it'll read right. That the New Testament writers were then mistaken when they so interpreted the prophecy, question mark. Let's see, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 up from the bottom. The sentence should read, or are they ready to confess that the Jews are right in maintaining that there is no such connection, which must mean, of course, that the New Testament writers were mistaken when they so interpreted the prophecy? With a question mark. Then a new sentence. For the Jews, and there's Jews, you see, so for the ad. For the Jews, if they reject the Messianic interpretation, the question is simply, who is referred to in the prophecy of the suffering servant? For the Christian, if he has any regard for the traditional belief of the church or for the teaching of the New Testament, the question is a double one. If the prophecy is not a prediction of the sufferings of Christ, what is its import and how is its New Testament interpretation to be accounted for? Because in the New Testament, it's quite clearly appealed to as applied to Christ. Yes?
In light of this continuity thing, I didn't really develop it all in my fiction, but I wonder if there's any parallel, the way it's used in the Old Testament regarding Christ as being a representative of Israel, but not necessarily, well, not the nation Israel, in regards to how it's used in the New Testament, the debate over the church being called Israel in a sense, but not really being strictly national Israel and so on.
Now, there might be some similarity, yeah. thought, you know. I think, you know, in the New Testament, the church is viewed as spiritually the seed of Abraham. And there's certainly a unity then in the people of God. And in a sense then, the church certainly participates in the promises and blessings that were promised to Israel in the spiritual sense. But that distinction of national versus spiritual, I think, is still one that is also there at the same time. So you have to do justice to both. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a similar sort of thing, perhaps. Okay. We could go into that in more detail, but I think there is good solid evidence that even among Jewish interpreters, particularly prior to the Middle Ages, there was the view that this was to be understood as a messianic prophecy, not as the nation. So that it's not only a Christian view, there's also good evidence of Jewish adherence to that understanding. Question?
Yeah, I'm just... I've read from like organizations like Jews for Jesus and so on, that in their readings in the synagogue, when they read the book of Isaiah and so on, they stop after Isaiah 52:12 and jump right to Isaiah 52:1.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they don't even read it anymore. And I had a Jewish roommate who, you know, also, you know, did the same thing, but they don't even deal with it.
Do you think that's because they feel so defensive about it that they don't feel they can adequately explain the passage without conceding?
How do they explain it?
Yeah.
To try to put it through when you're not consistent the whole way.
Yeah.
So better not to, to deal with it.
I wasn't aware of that. Those synagogue readings, I think they're standard books that map out, you know, this week you do this and this week you do that. And in... Is that probably what you're referring to? In that they move through Isaiah and then just move over that. That's interesting. All right, a couple other comments, just a general nature, before we start looking at it verse by verse. Another thing that I think is interesting is that from Isaiah 40 on, there's a great deal of stress on the matter of return from exile. And it's rather interesting when you come to this climactic passage of this series of servant passages that there's no reference to the exile at all. The exile sort of faded out of the picture. It's not even alluded to. But I think what's going on here is that what you find here in this climactic passage is God's answer to the more basic problem, the problem that's behind the exile. And that's the problem of sin. In fact, that's the problem why Israel couldn't fulfill the work of the servant, because Israel had sinned. And it's sin which has caused the exile. It's sin which causes all the ills of humanity. And it is that the issue that is dealt with in this passage. Now, 52:1-12 we haven't looked at. But 52:1-12 is a song of joy. Look at verse 7. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Verse 9, break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem, for the Lord hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. All the ends of the earth shall see salvation of God. A great hymn of joy in 52:1-12, and what you find in 52:13 and following is the reason for the joy. Sin has been atoned for. The work of the servant is that which solves that sin problem. So, let's look at the passage itself. Verse 13, "Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and be extolled and be very high." 13 announces the success of the servant in carrying out his work. I read from the King James, "Behold, my servant shall deal prudently." The Hebrew term there is yashkil, the verb form. It's translated "deal prudently." Yashkil. Basic idea of the word is to act wisely, and that is to be wise in doing things in a way that will bring results. To be wise in doing things in a way that will bring results. So it's frequently translated "prosper." Notice the NIV says, "See, my servant will act wisely," with a text translation note, "or will prosper." Will act wisely or will prosper. The rest of the verse consists of three verbs for exaltation. They are nasa, room, and gava. All of them have the idea of exaltation. And you notice the King James says, "He shall be exalted, be extolled, be very high." NIV says, "He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted." But they all have similar meanings. King James says for that second one, "be extolled." That's nasa. It's literally to be lifted up. So he shall be high, he shall be lifted up, and be very high. He shall be high, lifted up, and be very high. Now, Dale H., in his commentary, has an interesting suggestion at that point. He says, with these three verbs, here we have his resurrection, he shall be high. His ascension, he shall be lifted. I think, hesitate to say that that is being taught here on the basis of those verbs. I think it's more likely that the verbs emphasize his success by repetition in parallelism. He shall be raised, lifted up, and highly exalted. But certainly the success of the work of the servant in view in verse 13. When you come to 14, you have a contrast. 14 reads, I'm reading from the King James, and we'll look at some of the translation questions. "As many were astounded at thee, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations," as it flows on into 15. In contrast to verse 13, 14 speaks of the exaltation, it moves from the exaltation of Christ to his previous humiliation. And I think right at that point, you have something that probably would be very hard for the initial hearers and readers of this to understand. There's been some suggestion before of humiliation in 49:7a. "Thus saith the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel, his Holy One, to whom man despiseth." That's 49:7a in a servant passage. And in that passage, previous one, in 50, "I gave my back to the smiters." But there have been just brief suggestions about the humiliation of the servant. I think that 14 is not translated well in the King James, or the NIV, for that matter, for this reason. If you look at the Hebrew structure, it really centers around Ta Esher Kain Kain. It seems to me, and I don't quite understand why, in both the King James and the NIV, the translators really missed the structure. The word so at the beginning of the second phrase in Hebrew, you see, that is key. And the King James says, as many were astounded at thee, his visage was so marred. And it really should read, as many as were astounded at thee, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. See, the Cain Cain is that so. And there's a structure set up there. And the way it goes is this. As many as were astonished or astounded at thee, who is the thee? I think the thee is Israel. Israel's in exile. Israel is suffering. So as many as were astounded at thee, people were horrified at Israel because of the suffering they went through. Israel's the addressee all through chapter 52. So as many as were astounded at you, O Israel, so in a similar way, it's comparison, so in a similar way, his visage was marred more than any man. So as many as were astounded or horrified at you, Israel, so his visage was marred more than any man, that is the servants. There's a comparison. So there's a comparison between the humiliation of the servant and the humiliation of Israel. Yet when you think about the comparison, you have to realize at the same time there's an important difference between the two humiliations. The humiliation of Israel is a result of sin. It's proof of Israel's inability to carry out the work that was assigned to it. The humiliation of the servant, on the other hand, is not due to any sin of his own. Yet he must undergo humiliation, and the question is why. The answer to that question is in the next phrase, the second so. As many as were astounded at you, Israel, so his visage was marred more than any man, his form more than the sons of men, so shall he sprinkle many nations. Here, so in the sense of a result. So you see, just as, Kasher, so in a similar way, the servant's visage is marred, so as a result, he shall sprinkle many nations. I think that's the structure, the way it flows. Question? That'd be all right. Yeah, I think they carry the same meaning. So you get that interesting statement, so he shall sprinkle many nations. As a result of being humiliated, he will sprinkle many nations. The word translated sprinkle is this root, nazah, nun zayin hay. That is the word repeatedly used in Leviticus for the ceremonial cleansing of objects in the temple. So it carries that idea of cleansing. Sometimes that was done with water, sometimes with blood. But these objects were sprinkled to purify them. So I think when you read, so he shall sprinkle many nations, the purpose of the humiliation is to cleanse many nations. So So right at the beginning of this climactic passage, you have the central idea of the whole passage touched on. The servant is to cleanse or purify many nations as a result of his humiliation. And he will go through that humiliation, but the result of it is the purification of the nations. Now, that's at the heart then of the message of the passage. Yet, if you look at the Revised Standard Version, for example, you will read, so shall he startle many nations. Sprinkle is taken out. And it reads, so shall he startle many nations. There's a footnote. You might think the footnote will say, or sprinkle. The footnote says, the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. The meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. That's a footnote in the RSV. The word occurs 24 times. Nazah. 4 times in the cow, 20 times in the hip field. This is a hip field form. It's always translated sprinkle. So I don't think there's any question what it means. I mean, it's used in many other contexts. It's always translated sprinkle. There's no evidence that that isn't its meaning. I think the only problem is some may feel the word doesn't make sense in this context. The Septuagint translates the phrase, thus shall many nations wonder at him. It's thalmazo. Thus shall many nations wonder at him. And that seems to be based on the parallelism in the passage, as many were astounded, you see, and then many wonder. It's sort of parallel with that. But the Hebrew text itself is clear. It says sprinkle. And the meaning of the term is quite clear. It's not, as the RSV says, the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain.
Yeah.
No, it's a perfectly normal third masculine singular hip field form. Yeah. Yeah, you see, that's the same thing with the King James. Yeah. Yeah, see, just as they, as many were appalled at him, you see, the so then, so his appearance was disfigured beyond that of any man, born beyond human likeness. So will he sprinkle a nation. That's this Cain structure. I don't understand, but the King James has that too. I don't understand why the King James and the NIV both translate that way. What's the NASB at? Someone. Follows what I was saying. So, so. Just as so, so.
Yeah, so and thus.
Yeah, all right, so and thus. I think it's clearly the way it should be read. The Anchor Bible says for this phrase, so shall he sprinkle many nations. The Anchor Bible says, so many nations will be astonished. So many nations will be astonished. Footnote in the Anchor Bible says, conjectural emendation based on the versions. Yeah. And in fact, if you look at the Hebrew Bible footnotes on this word, it's really amazing. See, if the phrase reads, Cain Yazeh. Yazeh is the Nazah Hifil form. Goyim Ravim. So he will sprinkle many nations. Perfectly straightforward and clear. If you look at the old Hebrew Bible, that LFRT means read perhaps. Yishta'u, you make it a plural. Third masculine plural, Hifil and perfect of Sha'ah Gezeh. No manuscript evidence. Just says read perhaps. That's a conjectural emendation. PRPS, the editor proposes. Third masculine plural, cow imperfect from ragaz, be agitated. Conjectural emendation. No manuscript evidence. Or VEL, that is, or yishtachwu, third masculine plural, hispel imperfect, shaha, bow down.
Right.
Yeah. You come to BHS, That's all been changed, but you, one proposal is, it has been proposed, PRP, Termesis of your cow and perfect from Nazag, just a change from a cow to a, from a hip field to a cow. I don't think, although you see, Nazag can mean in its root meaning to spurt or spatter. I think that's how some people try to get startled out of spurt or spatter. Or Yazoo, a cow imperfect with a third masculine plural. So then that you see the nations would be the subject, not instead of he will sprinkle the nations. Or then purely conjecture this this form of ragaz, same as up here, be agitated, or baza, despise. But it's just amazing the amount of conjectural emendation that's proposed in order to substitute something for a word that's perfectly clear. At least it's perfectly clear to me. If you look at where is that text in the New Testament? Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. Is it 1:1 or 1:2? You have the same idea. Yeah, 1:2. Elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through sanctification of the Spirit unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. The sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. That is that purifying agent. Now, you see, the first phrase then of 15, you have a bad verse division there. The first phrase of 15 really flows with 14. As many as were astounded at you, so his visage was marred more than any man is born the sons of men, so he will sprinkle many nations. Yes.
In regards to this theme of the sprinkling, is this one of the first the clear pictures of Christ with the priest? Is this a specific
I would think so. I mean, I can't think of an earlier passage.
It would be unmistakable in the Jewish mind.
You would think so, clearly. Because that word is used in Leviticus, as I mentioned, 24 times of sprinkling. Yeah. So the first phrase of 15 goes better with the last part of 14 than with what follows in 15. So the verse division there is again 4. But when you get to 15 then, you find that kings are filled with awe at that which they see. It's something they would not have believed possible. The kings shall shut their mouths at him. For that which had not been told them they shall see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. So the result is prominent people are affected by this work of the servant. So by means of humiliation, the servant accomplishes his work. He sprinkles the nations for cleansing, and the result is prominent people are affected by it. Yes?
In the CDB, they take one of the definitions is scarlet, and it seems to me that they suggest the root of something Arabic or Aramaic. But that's all it says. And then another dictionary I have, I looked it up, another second definition is scarlet, but they don't give any.
Yeah. Well, some have said that the idea of startle is found by assuming that just as one causes water or blood to jump when you sprinkle it, so he causes the nations to jump or leap. And as you say, some have suggested a similar Arabic root that means to leap. That means to leap. But usually, yeah. Got some an example here, huh? But usually, as you notice on this BHS, usually it's simply suggested that we must make a conjectural emendation because the sense doesn't make sense the way it is.
Right. But is there any support for something like an Arabic?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think so. If you really had a text that absolutely made no sense, you might search for something like that. But it seems in a case like this, where you have other uses of the term, and the other uses of the term are quite clear, and the idea of sprinkling a sense of purification is a quite common concept, that there's no need to be looking for some sort of rather obscure alternative source for the thing. All right, 53:1. Who hath believed our report? To whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? You have a rhetorical question. Young suggests it's designed to call attention to the few who believe. Who hath believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? In other words, the unexpected nature of the way in which the Lord has brought salvation means that many people don't recognize its true meaning. The few who believe, who hath believed our report, to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? The reason for that attitude is given in verse 2. For he shall grow up before him like a tender plant and like a root out of the dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. In verse 2, first of all, you find his origin is not what one might have expected. He grows up like a tender plant, like a root out of dry ground. His origin is not what one might have expected. It's a humble origin. And then also, he doesn't have the outward attractiveness that you might expect of a deliverer. Pardon? Yeah. He comes from Israel. And Israel, at the time of Christ, was an insignificant nation. Who would think from that small, insignificant group would come one who would bring deliverance to the world? He's a root out of dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness. He died a criminal death. Certainly the cross isn't a picture of what of you would expect of a conqueror, a deliverer. He wasn't the general of a great army. He wasn't a great political figure. So verse 2 doesn't refer to his character or his life, in which there was great beauty, but to his humble origin and to his death. His humble origin and his death. He grew up like a root out of dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness. There's no beauty that we should desire. All right, verse 3. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. We hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Verse 3 continues the description of the sorrow and misery connected with his death. He was conspired against by people of his own nation. He was subjected to torture and death at the hands of the Romans. King James translates there, he was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Those two words, I think, are translated a bit too broadly in the King James, sorrows and grief. The first one, makkao, is a masculine noun that means pain. The second one, chali, is a noun that means sickness or disease, or pain that comes from wounds. So I think what's in view there, he was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. The sorrows and the grief are referring to the physical pain that he bore in a time of his suffering. That flows on into verse 4. When you read 4, surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. The word griefs and sorrows, the same words there, but they're narrower than the translation suggests. I don't think they indicate sorrow and grief in general, but more specifically, physical injury, sickness. I think a better translation is, he has borne our sicknesses and carried our pains. Look at page 31, 32 of your citations. I've taken a paragraph there on this from Dr. McCrae's Gospel of Isaiah. That's a couple paragraphs. Let's look at this and then we'll take a break. Page 31, which comes from page 136 to 138 of the Gospel of Isaiah. Verse 4, McCrae says, has often been misunderstood, largely because two quite specific words have been taken in a rather general sense. The Hebrew makes a sharp contrast between the first and second parts of the verse. It puts great stress on the pronoun he at the beginning of the first part, in contrast to a similarly emphasized we in the second part. You see, surely he hath borne our griefs, carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God. Presenting a contrast between what he did and what we thought. This contrast is further indicated by the fact that the verse begins with a Hebrew word generally translated surely or truly. In the attempt to bring out the contrast more fully, this word has been rendered as indeed in the translation above. That's McCrae's own. The first two verbs in the verse are common Hebrew words for carrying or lifting, and generally also involve the idea of removing something or taking it away. The nouns used with them are literal words for, notice, physical suffering and infirmities. The King James rendered griefs and sorrows is much too general. The clause pictures the healing ministry of Christ. This is clearly stated in Matthew 8, 16 to 17, where it is said that his healing works were done, quote, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. In the last part of this verse, the observers confessed their error. Even though they had seen his great miracles, they had completely misunderstood the situation when he was seized and killed. It grieved them that such a good man could be stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. This was doubtless the feeling of many who were later converted on the day of Pentecost. It was certainly true of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. As they told the man whom they took for a stranger about their great sorrow over the death of the one whom they had seen work so many miracles and whom they had hoped would redeem Israel, but it seemed like that hope was gone. Jesus himself pointed to his great miracles of healing as evidence of the truth of his claims. This is brought out clearly in John 5:36, 10:38, 14:11. Those who had seen his great miracles of healing had failed to put full confidence in his claims to be divine. Now, however, they realized that his death was not the result of divine displeasure, but had an entirely different meaning, which is brought out in Isaiah 53:5. Interpreters have sometimes read the atonement back into the first half of verse 4. Surely hath borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. Translating pains and diseases in the general sense of grief, suffering, or sorrows. However, even if translated in this general way, griefs and sorrows are not a normal way of expressing the idea of sin. Many Bibles give marginal references here to Matthew 8, 16 to 17, 1 Peter 2, 24. Actually, 1 Peter 2, 24 is only one word in common with the first half of Isaiah 53, 4, the word bore. The verse gives a clear statement of the atonement of Christ and quotes from Isaiah 53, 5, but it's a mistake to think of it as also quoting from verse 4. So, you see, McCrae's point is, verse 4 is not really talking about the atoning work of Christ in that first part of it. Surely hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, as the King James translates it. It's talking about the healing ministry of Christ, which should have been evidence of who he was. Yet when people saw his miracles and then later saw him crucified, they esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. They failed to recognize who he was in spite of the fact of the miracles he had performed. So the contrast is what he did and yet what those who saw him did, the we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. So they saw his works, yet thought that the fact that he had, was taken and crucified proved him not to be the Savior. So they were perplexed. Okay, question or comment on 4? Well, let's take a 10-minute break.